This episode of Recovery Rocks is sponsored by SoberLink. And Lisa and I know that it's not just recovery that rocks, but waking up clear-headed rocks, remembering what you did the night before rocks, and so does establishing healthy relationships and accountability with the people that you love.
And we know that can be hard. SoberLink's remote alcohol monitoring system is designed to help you reclaim stability in your life and sustain a sober lifestyle. It's trusted by thousands of treatment professionals nationwide.
Click the link in our show notes to learn more about SoberLink and get $50 off your device. Shout out to SoberLink.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. Welcome. It's Lisa. And here, as always, with my BFF.
Meow.
You're like getting later and later on that chime in.
Meow, meow. Hey, it's Tawny. Hello, my love. Sorry, my cat stole the mic.
Yeah. Meg White. We are really excited today. We have with us Sarah Levy, who is the author of this amazing book, Drinking Games. You might have seen us promote it. Outside of this, it is part memoir, part cultural observation and critique. It's really terrific. And just a little background about Sarah. She's a writer based in LA by way of New York, and her work examines the intersection of sobriety, relationships, and identity. And she's been featured in the New York Times, New York Magazine, The Cut, Cosmopolitan, Glamour, Vogue, Elle. She's in all the places. She's been in all the cool places. And Drinking Games is her first book. And go get it. It's wonderful. And we're thrilled to have her here with us. And welcome, Sarah, and maybe introduce yourself a little bit in the book.
Thank you. What a nice introduction. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here and to talk to you guys. And yeah, you said it best. I'm Sarah. I am 33. I live in Los Angeles now. I got sober when I was 28 and living in New York. And I never intended to write or talk so publicly about being sober. It just sort of happened. And these days, I write a lot about my recovery. My book, Drinking Games, is a memoir and essays. And I talk a lot about my blackouts, my road to sobriety, and then different areas of my life and how they were impacted by my drinking and then my sobriety. So everything from relationships, my career, mental health, and so much more. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. It's one of the things that I loved about this book is that, you know, for me, I'm generations older. And it has been amazing to see the story of somebody, you know, young and cool and running around New York City, doing all the things at 28. I got sober at 38. So to think of what it was like, what it would have been like to get sober at 28, it's a big deal. You're kind of in your prime, especially, you know, of being social, going out, having all the things going on. And I feel like, for listeners out there who are, whether they're sober, sober curious, just taking a look at alcohol, I really encourage reading this book because you get a really good glimpse of not just, okay, it's, you know, the challenge of getting sober, of doing all of those things and doing the work, but also like, wow, how much better, you know, you feel and how much, mm-hmm. you know, the things that I was afraid of being, if I had been, say, 28 when I was getting sober, you're showing people the other side in a way that I think hasn't quite been done before, in a really powerful way for, you know, people in their 20s, people in their early 30s to be identifying with in a different way. And I thought that was really great. And you have a really great way of kind of putting these things in a context. Like, I would love for you to talk a little bit about, for example, your experience with Bachelor Nation.
Yeah, definitely. Well, also, I just want to say that, you know, I, looking back now at who I was when I was 28 and the fact that I got sober then, it's still a miracle to me because I feel like I had this tiny window where I was just like desperate and willing enough to do something different than what I had been doing. And I've just kind of kept doing that one day at a time since then. But to your point, you know, I was single and young and running around New York City and terrified to stop drinking. So just always like to say that for anyone listening, if it sounds impossible, it felt that way to me too. And it did get a lot easier. And like you said, I started to feel so much better. And in terms of Bachelor Nation, one of the essays in my book is about moderation and how for the last 5 years of my drinking, I was really obsessed with this idea of trying to moderate my alcohol consumption and just drink like a normal person, you know, have one or two glasses of wine. And like I said, the last thing I wanted to do was be completely sober. That just sounded like a death sentence. And like, I would never have fun again and my life would be over. And so I was really like relentless in my pursuit of the perfect relationship with alcohol. And in the book, I write about how this journey and obsession with moderation coincided with my like bachelor era, which I'm like not really in as much anymore. But in my 20s, my early 20s, like mid 20s living in New York, I watched The Bachelor and Bachelorette on Monday nights with like a group of friends. And there was always, you know, sushi or takeout and wine, a lot of wine. And I think Bachelor Nation is sort of synonymous with like wine culture and like drinking on a Monday night. And they definitely drink on the show. And you know, I would every week spend whatever 2 hours, they really drag it out, watching The Bachelor with a group of other women my age and really like paying attention to how they were drinking, you know? And what I was so interested and it was the fact that like a lot of them were able to have one or two glasses of wine and it didn't like ruin their Tuesday, you know? And for me, like on Monday nights, I was usually still recovering from the weekend. And so I was either like punishing myself and, you know, swearing that I wasn't going to drink again, which I always ended up drinking again by like Wednesday or Thursday. Or I was like, whatever, screw it. I'm going to drink. It's bachelor night. And then waking up on Tuesday, feeling horrible, feeling hungover. So it was just this real back and forth. And, you know, and I was also just sort of fascinated by this idea that I was different than people who looked like me, who, you know, had the same background. We had all gone to college. We all had jobs. And I didn't understand why when they started to drink and we were all gathering to do the same thing, watch a TV show, why they had such a different reaction to alcohol than I did.
Yeah.
That was one of my big moments as well. Like just watching how other people could drink normally, even mm-hmm. still I'm 7.5 years sober and it's still, it's like a magic trick seeing someone leave a half full pint at the bar. I'm just like, how did they do that? My brain cannot compute how they do that, but it's like, I like how you mentioned being, like, maybe that was like the first time that you were becoming aware of like, I don't drink like these people, you know? And I had moments like that where it was like, I would be at a bar with some friends after a writing class and they would all have one or two drinks and I'd be at the bar ordering rounds of shots for the table. And they'd look at me like, why are you ordering shots? And I was like, cause it's Tuesday. Like, let's take shots. And, you know, but like that feeling of like, oh, we drink differently, you know, like it finally started to register with me that maybe this is unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. And I think in a bar setting, it was easier for me to spend time with the other people who were down to take a shot or, you know, tell myself that like, it was fine because we were all like going out and some people were just more fun than others. Like, sorry that I'm so fun, you know, but on a Monday in someone's apartment when people are like still in their work clothes and, you know, talking about like their workouts the next day or whatever they have going on. I just was really aware of how differently I drank. And yeah, it was one of those first moments where I was sort of like, I feel like there's something different about my relationship with alcohol.
And so when you stopped drinking, you still had those friends. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the things that I realized when I got sober, I was so afraid like my friends were going to abandon me if I didn't drink, because that's what we did. We went out, you know, we did things running around the city. And I almost felt like I was an imposition on them when I stopped drinking. And that they, you know, I didn't want anybody to change the way they were or the way they would drink or what they would do just because I was around. And they would just be like, relax, you know, what's wrong with you? You're fine. Like, we get it. We want to support you. And this big thing, I had these fears, and then it was like, oh no, not at all. And those people that were in my book, I write about my tight friends who were around when I got sober, and they're still my tight friends 19 years later. And how was your experience with all of that? Because that's a question people have a lot, is what's it going to mean for my friendships?
Oh my gosh, that I was so afraid that if I got sober, you know, you hear like people, places, and things, I'm going to have to get all new friends. And I didn't want to get new friends. You know, I had a couple of people who I drank really heavily with, and they were more like party friends, and we're not as close anymore. But the core, my core group of tight girlfriends were really not drinking as much as I was. You know, we would go to dinner and we would go out together, but like there was a point in the night where they were getting Ubers and they were going home, and I was kind of staying out with whoever was left, you know? And so very similar to your experience, I remember kind of like outing myself and saying like, I'm sober, and it was really dramatic. And they were like, that's great. Like, you know, and I,
yeah,
it was
yeah,
like,
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember like, they were like, we love you. Like, we don't really care. And I think even now it's interesting because I've been so public. I wrote a book about my sobriety, and, you know, they love me and they came to my book events and they're happy for me. They read my book, but like, I still think sometimes they're like, okay, cool. You know, what else is going on, you know? And
yeah, right. Right.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. That's so funny. That's so true.
Which is great. Sweat.
As like, so we're all sober authors here. So how has your, if at all, has your recovery changed since you've gone public, since you're talking about it? You're on so many podcasts right now. Like, are you learning more about yourself, more about your recovery while writing and promoting the book?
It's such a good question. And I'm excited to talk to you guys about it, as other women in recovery who are public and talk about it. It's been really interesting. I think, you know, in the very beginning of promoting the book, and even before publishing the book, sort of like in the stage that you're in right now, Tony, like you're starting to do promotion. The book isn't out yet. It's really exciting. And I am still like really grateful for the opportunity to share my story and to reach other people, right, who might be struggling and in a place that I was in 6 years ago. What's been interesting and what sort of happened is, you know, like anything else, you sort of develop like a little script or your talking points, right? You're talking about when you got sober and what it was like, and then the journey to writing the book. And my recovery has always been this really, like, this safe space where I can be super honest. And I think I've found myself, and it really depends, I think, also on the context of the conversations. Like when I'm talking to someone else who's also in recovery, I can be really honest and talk about things in a little bit of a different way, versus maybe when I'm talking to someone who isn't sober. I don't know. I feel like I'm almost like trying to convince them or like trying to make it sound really, you know, attractive. And I have to remind myself like what they think about sobriety or
yeah.
Like, sobriety is like really none of my business. I'm just here to like tell the truth, like I've been doing. But I have needed to like really schedule in time for myself, whether that's like recovery meetings or time with other sober women one-on-one, where I'm just like having really honest conversations about how I'm feeling. It's like a, I don't know. I'm curious for you guys too, like how you feel talking about your recovery so often, and if it's really always been helpful, or if you have reached points where you're like, I feel like this is all I'm talking about, and it's like losing its like that quality that it kind of had at the beginning.
I will say we recently had Simone Finch, who's the creator of Single Drunk Female. She was on the show recently. Mm-hmm. And she had a great point. She was like, she was cutting back on meetings because she was like, well, I'm talking about recovery all day at work. Mm-hmm. And she had to realize that's not working on my recovery. Like mm-hmm. I'm just talking about yeah. it. And mm-hmm. with that also come like the emotional weight of educating people about recovery. That's mm-hmm. not your job, but it ends up being your job because you're promoting a book about recovery. So
yeah,
just that. I really yeah. appreciated her saying that because it helped me. It really helps me compartmentalize of like, what is my recovery and how is my recovery personal? Like, what is mine? What, mm-hmm. what do only I know and people that are really close to me know? And then what do I feel comfortable sharing with the world? And those mm-hmm. are two very different things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for me, it was like very similar. I remember at the beginning, I was still working. I was the deputy executive director at a law firm in New York when my book came out. And they were great about letting me run around and speak and work remotely and do all this stuff. And so I was working like crazy and doing book stuff. And I do 12 step also, like you do. And my sponsor was like, when are you getting to meetings? And I was like, oh, my whole life is a meeting now. And she was like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, no, it's not.
Yeah. So that is the distinction.
Right. Definitely.
It's still like, it's just, I guess it's just prioritizing, you know, and knowing what you need one day at a time. And it's also like reminding myself that when I do go on a podcast or write an essay or something, it's not up to me to explain recovery. Mm-hmm. It's just up to me to explain my story, to talk about this book, this article, whatever it is. There's enough free resources out there. You know, we don't have to be all of it, but it's this balance of like you said, when you're on a podcast, you feel like you have to almost sell sobriety of like, it's really cool, I promise. Because there is this, in the rise of, you know, the ubiquity of sober curiosity, it's like people are really interested in this conversation right now. So I do want to hold space and acknowledge that and like be the, you know, that. And I think the overlap there is like being of service is the through line, whether it's my personal recovery or my career as a recovery advocate. Mm-hmm. Being of service shows up in both places very strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also, you know, as women in recovery who have like a platform and who are public about it, I feel a degree of like responsibility, right? To your point about educating people about recovery and also sort of this conversation that's happening now about like closing the gender gap in or, you know, depictions of sobriety, right? With shows like Single Drunk Female and the rise of, you know, sober curious influencers. And for me, when I was contemplating sobriety, sober curious wasn't in my vocabulary at the time, right? So contemplating it, I couldn't find women who were normal, quote unquote, you know, and had big lives and were, you know, young and choosing to be sober. And so I do always have that in the back of my mind when I'm having these conversations of who's the 24-year-old who might be listening to this.
Yes.
And, right. Like, yes. I don't know this. But I do think that is such a great point that, you know, this is not a meeting. Like, my recovery is separate arena than these conversations, right? This is service, this is work, this is a different venue.
Yeah.
It's a really tough balance.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really wanted to talk about, because I think the way you handle it in the book is so great, is the issue and everything around social media and, you know, everything being for the gram and how, you know, how that might be influencing, like you mentioned, like talking about that 24-year-old who might be listening, who might be thinking about sober curiosity, like how to think about social media and what its impacts maybe have been on you or were on you and what you see there. Because you write about it beautifully.
Thank you. You know, I think I just recently saw this somewhere that millennials are the last generation who can remember a time before and after social media. So I grew up right until I was 16, really, without social media. There was AOL Instant Messenger. And so I was sort of online, but it was different. I wasn't posting pictures for public consumption and sort of thinking of how it was being viewed in that context. And then 16 onward, there's Facebook. And then when I graduated college, Instagram. And so a lot of this like formative time in my life, these very formative years have been marked by social media and how I present myself to my network, right? And then now to like just the larger world, because we're all really public, whether or not we have public profiles or not. And I think like first and foremost, it's had such an impact on how I view myself, my body, my clothes, my appearance, right? This idea of how we pose in pictures and how we look and our background and where we are and geotagging, you know, are you at a cool restaurant? Are you at like the party that everyone else is at? I think in my early 20s, being in New York, I was very conscious of that, you know, looking at people's posts and then later stories in real time, seeing like, where is everybody? Where are they drinking? Or where are they hanging out? Was I invited? You know, and I think it just really amplified a lot of the like normal insecurities and feelings that you're having at that age. But putting it on a platform where everyone can be consuming it in real time is really intense. And I think it just continues, you know, like I always think about the fact that now my generation is getting married, having kids, having second kids, and posting and posting and posting. And it's like, you know, we can kind of continue to play the compare and despair game with like, this person bought a house and this person's kids are perfectly dressed. And oh my God, do they have an interior designer or decorator? Like their home is perfect and they're going on vacations. And it's just a different level of same feelings that I remember having with social media when I was younger, which was like, I'm not enough. Everyone's doing more and, you know, making it look better. And with in terms of drinking, you know, and how that kind of played into my relationship with social media, I think I really held on to this idea of like the cool girl and the party girl and posting about that. You know, if I didn't feel like I was measuring up in my romantic life, I was really overcompensating with posting about my job and being like, I'm crushing it at work, or then like going out and being like, I'm at this cool bar and I'm working out all the time. Like, I feel like I look hot in this picture. And it was just all about performing so that other people think that I was okay, because I didn't feel like I was.
Thank you for sharing all of that. That's super vulnerable and relatable. So I'm going to be vulnerable back. And this is kind of cringeworthy and I'm embarrassed, but whatever. So I love how you said compare. What is it? Compare and despair.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Did you coin that, or is that like
I can't take credit for that. That's like a recovery term that
it's from, recovery. Yeah.
Okay. I love that. For listeners who don't know about what a publisher's marketplace screenshot is, in the publishing world, when you get a book deal, you get a publisher's marketplace announcement, an author's posted on Instagram. And it's like, it's this big moment for a writer's career. It means I got a book deal, you know, and it's huge. Mm-hmm. So when I was trying to get my book deal, I was like, anytime I would see a fellow, you know, contemporary getting a deal, I would take it as a personal attack, you know, because I was like,
yes,
oh yeah, I'm a piece of shit. Of course I didn't get a book deal yet. And of course they did. And I remember when I saw your publisher's marketplace, and I was just like, I was just like, I felt so defeated, because I was like, she's writing a book about, she's in her 30s. She's talking about sobriety, sex and relationships, cultural criticism. And I was like, I don't even think I was querying agents yet at this point, but I felt so defeated. I was like, what's the point? The book's already out there. And then I called Lisa, I called my writing coach, and I was like, they were like, they're very different books.
Yeah.
Like, cause my book is not a memoir, you know, but I was just, but you know, when you're in that really sensitive, artistic space of like how frustrating it is to get a book deal. Yeah. So I just, I was debating on telling you that, but you were so vulnerable.
I actually remember that.
Yeah. Do you really?
Yeah. Because I was like, don't worry. I did the same thing with Sarah Heppel's Blackout. It came out a year before my book. And it's okay.
These Sarahs. These Sarahs are getting book deals before us.
Tani, thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate the vulnerability and I relate so much. I really do. I do the exact same thing. I did the exact same thing with writers who were writing in a completely different genre, but were just around my age. You know, like I saw every book deal that someone else was getting as a personal slight that like, and this was like in sobriety still, really definitely pre-sobriety. I felt this about like pretty much any good thing that someone else had. I was like, well, that's one less good thing for me. And then definitely like still even in sobriety. And I remember having a conversation with a sober girlfriend and she was just like, you know, there's so much space on bookshelves. Like there's enough room for multiple books. Right. And the more stories that we have in this category, the better, because someone could pick up my book and not really relate to it and totally relate to what your book is about, you know? And I just like really relate, and I do it. I'm still doing it to a certain extent. Yeah. I'm working on my second book and I'm seeing authors getting like second book deals and getting their first books like adapted for TV and film.
Yeah.
And that's not going to happen for me because it happened for them. And I think, you know, we talk about like, I've heard conversations about like abundance and abundance mindset, right? And having a mindset of like abundance versus scarcity. And I think for me, like those feelings always come from a scarcity mindset and feeling like I'm not good enough. They're better than me. And like one thing has nothing to do with the other. Like there's room for both of us. And
clearly.
Clearly. And like, I just want to say thank you because like knowing that still, you came to my book launch in New York. You've been so gracious to me and so supportive of the book. You're having me on your podcast. And like, that is just not something that I would have been capable of before sobriety. I would have just like, okay, like we're in a battle, you know, we're not. And instead like, no, we have the same goal. We're, you know, we can like have a really cool conversation and friendship. Mm-hmm. And that's so much more powerful than the alternative.
Absolutely. And it's funny you say that because it's like, in my own head, it was like this, it's almost just like a fight that isn't even real, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's a thing we create in our own minds. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's not real at all. Like your book deal has nothing to do with me. You know, Sarah Heppel's book deal had nothing to do with Lisa's. But it's just, I think it shows how important, I think just we take our craft, we take our work very seriously. And I guess to echo the previous conversation of like, how do you draw the line between recovery and your job? That's tough, especially in this context.
Yeah.
And also go ahead.
I was just going to say quickly, like I have to also zoom out, you know, and remind myself that there are so many books that are written about love. There are so many books that are written about, you know, there are so many young adult novels. There are so many mystery
rom-coms, horror. Like there's
space, right? There's space for different versions of, you know, our books have the same umbrella theme, but we're telling different stories.
And we all need each other. Like we are our own community. Yeah. Like this, you know, the Quitlet author community. Like we all exist because of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would say our work exists because of each other's work.
Definitely. Yeah. Like I read Sarah Heppela in 2015, years before I got sober, you know, and I remember that book having such an impact on me. I read Caroline Knapp's book years prior to that. You know, it's like my book wouldn't exist if it weren't for theirs.
Mm-hmm. And say, I think that we can both say the same for Lisa, like but Quitlet wasn't even a term yet, you know, when Lisa's book came out and it was so ahead of its time.
I wouldn't go that far, but
take the compliment.
Yeah. All right. I'm taking the compliment. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I was just going to say this all gets perpetuated by social media as well. Right. Because you know, and in the times before social media, like when I was doing this, I didn't have this whole perspective of what was going on in a wider world. you know, I just saw what would turn up on the bookshelf kind of thing. And it was harder. And there is just one more thing I did want to get into a little bit is I love how you look at the wellness culture and the idea of what wellness is and is not. And I think, you know, it's like every time I see a yoga and wine thing advertised and my head explodes. I think there's a lot of influencer culture out there. So I don't know if there was anything you wanted to sort of add to mention
Yeah. It's, you know, now even living in LA, I could write like a whole second chapter on that because it's here too. And I think before I got sober, I really subscribed to wellness culture as like the answer. So anytime I had a really bad night of drinking, like I would do a juice cleanse or I would sign up for a bunch of workout classes that week, or I would start like a new running program, even though I hate running. And, you know, I thought that all these outside things were the answer. I thought that, you know, if my body looked healthy, then like my insides would be healthy too. And I think now like influencer and wellness culture is just next level, you know, and there's not just Instagram, there's TikTok where you're seeing these videos like in like every single day, what I ate in a day or what my workout plan is and comparing yourself to other people's bodies. And I think it can just be for anyone who identifies as like an alcoholic or just maybe has alcohol use disorder, whatever it is. Like for me, the symptom was always more. Like I want more. Once I start to drink, I want more. And I think it's so easy to pick up that same mentality with wellness because it's like, it's not just fruits and vegetables and water and like going for a walk. It's, I want more supplements. I want more skincare products. I want more fancy workout classes. I want like, what are the procedures people are doing? How does everyone look so shiny and healthy? Right. And I think it can just be really exhausting and it takes on a life of its own. And the like irony of it all is some of the prettiest, you know, fittest people that I've ever met are not well, you know, they're like,
oh yeah,
their insides are not well.
And, yeah.
Or they're not mentally well. And so it's just a lot of smoke and mirrors and it's a business, right? Like they're selling products, they're selling, right. They're working with brands and promoting a lifestyle. And, yeah, I also, this is like a separate tangent, but before I picked up alcohol, food and exercise were really like my first kind of drugs of choice. Like that was how I used to control how I felt about myself and my body. And so I think it is a slippery slope with, for me now, even in my recovery, I'm happy that I'm sober. I wake up clear-headed and I don't have a hangover, but I have to really like watch myself with the culture stuff because I can make that the answer really quickly.
Yeah, I was just telling Lisa earlier today how I feel like I'm finally in a place where I don't need to justify a meal or like I don't have to run an extra mile the next day to make up for something that I ate. Like I'm in a place where I exercise because I like it and I eat what I want. It's a one day at a time thing too, but I think just being women, you know, that's just going to be an ongoing recovery of its own.
Yeah, I agree.
It's so hard. Before we transition to music, I have a quick pop culture question.
Okay.
As you know, there is an actress named Sarah Levy. Yes. Do you get Google alerts for her stuff? And like, is that, so if for listeners, Sarah Levy she's on Schitt's Creek. She's, you know, Daniel Levy's sister, Eugene Levy's daughter. And yeah, I'm just curious about that.
I don't have Google alerts, but I get so many book reviews and messages from people thinking that the book was written by her. Like there are some really funny reviews that are like, this book was interesting, but I thought it would be funnier. Like she didn't mention Creek. She didn't mention Eugene Levy. Like, and like, there's some sections about my dad in the book. They're like, it didn't sound like Eugene Levy at all. Like,
oh my God.
People who read the whole thing thinking that it was by the other Sarah Levy.
Did they not look at the author photo in the back?
I know. And I have gotten some messages from people being like, I loved you on Schitt's Creek. Like, so excited about your book. So just like really funny, sweet things. But I love Schitt's Creek and I think Sarah Levy is awesome. So I'm like happy to share the SEO with
yeah.
her.
Yeah. I love that. I'm so glad I asked. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're on Recovery Rock. So we end every episode talking about music. Is there any music that means something to your recovery or even just something that you're obsessed with right now?
I have to shout out the Hamilton soundtrack because
oh, yeah.
I write a little bit about that in my book. It was really like defined, I think, most of our 2016, 2015, 2016s, especially like being in New York. And it sounds cheesy, but like it had a profound impact on me because I felt like so just like such a piece of shit, for lack of a better term. I was like nearing the end of my drinking. I didn't feel like I was doing anything productive. I wasn't accomplishing anything. And I would walk around New York listening to Hamilton and listening to that line, like, how do you write? Like you're running,
like out of time. Yep.
And I was just like, oh, like to feel like that, to have that like passion and output. And it just, it really inspired me. And I got sober, I guess a year after I saw the show, not because of Hamilton, but it did, it did really have an impact on me and I just love it. So I would say that that had that, I really connect that with my recovery.
I love that. Just the whole soundtrack is incredible. That line, the why do you write like you're running out of time, that just, I feel that in my bones. Like when I'm furiously writing, I'm just like, thank you, Lynn. I feel so seen.
And also, there's like lyrics about legacy. You know, what is a legacy? What do you want to leave behind? Right. And just these like larger themes. I mean, it's so brilliant, the whole show. But I felt like I wasn't doing anything at the time. And I was like, what will my legacy be if I keep drinking this way? You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think your legacy is going to be great. And even if it is confused with someone else.
Thank you.
So remind our listeners where they can, like, we're going to have links to everything in the show notes, but just remind listeners how they can find your work, what the book is called, anything else you want to share.
Definitely. So the book is called Drinking Games. You can find me on Instagram at Sarah with an H L Levy. And my website is the same, sarahllevy.com. And you can buy Drinking Games wherever you like to support, wherever you like to buy books. It's online and it's at your local bookstore.
Awesome. Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for hanging with us, Sarah.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. This was great. This was great. Everybody buy the book. It's awesome.
Thank you. This was awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Here it is.
Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. If so, please hit subscribe and consider rating and reviewing us so others can find us. Tawny, how can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Tawny M. Lara on all of the social medias. You can find my blog, sobrietyparty.com. Lisa, how can we find you and your amazing book?
My book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it is available at bookstores everywhere and online. And you can find me at LisaSmithAdvisory.com. And I'm on social media at Girl Walks Out. Thanks for listening.